we left off last week, I believe, on Daf Ayin Hamad Beis. We had started the Gemara, and after the Mishnah, it's about 13 lines. The words are Amar Rav Nachman. 13 lines down from where the Gemara begins. And so the Gemara, until this point, had presented the requirement of when you buy new kelim, new, as we'll see, the Gemara will clarify kitchen vessels, right? If you buy a pocket knife or you buy a screwdriver, so we don't say it's a metal kli, but we don't say you have to do tefillah on it. But the Gemara has already established that when you have a kli bought from a non-Jew, and they haven't spoken about any of the details yet, but you have to put it in the mikveh before you use it. So Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Bar Havua. Afilu kelim chadoshim b'mashma, even new kelim. In other words, the requirement to tefilas kelim has nothing to do. It's not like doing hagalah or doing libun. It's like none of those things. And how does he know? Because the hayishanim v'libnam, if you buy used kelim, and then you kasher them, you do libun on them or whatever you do, kichadoshim damu. Particularly libun. When you do libun, it's like it's a new kli here. And vafilu hachi boi tevila. And nonetheless, they require immersion in the mikvah. So it has nothing to do with getting non-kosher stuff out, but rather it has to do with...
Doesn't it have to do with the source? So if it comes from a guy...
Correct. Right? So the Ran... I mentioned this last week. The Ran here quotes a Yushalmi. And what the Yushalmi says is that the reason why kelim require tevila is because it's ole mitumasan shel goyim lekdushasan shel Yisrael. It's coming from the impurity of the non-Jews who owned it to the sanctity of a Jew using it. Did I not talk about this last week? Okay, I never know. So really, I think what this tells us is that our table is really like a mizbeach. The Gemara makes that analogy. The Gemara says, I forget where the Gemara is, that when there was a Beis HaMikdash, so the mizbeach, the altar, achieved atonement. But today, we have no mizbeach, we have no altar, and in lieu of it, what we have is our shulchan, our table. And when we use our table to feed the poor and to bring in guests, so that is how we achieve atonement, that is how we achieve kapara. So when we look at eating is not simply a mundane activity. Eating is really a holy activity in every way, both how we prepare the food, in terms of brachos before and brachos afterwards, and apparently even the utensils that are used, even the klei suda, require a kind of kedusha, a kind of sanctity, and that's why they require tefillah. So when you buy it from, when you create it, so it's created in a context that's Jewish already, or if you buy it from a Jew who's presumably already done tefillah, it doesn't require tefillah. When you're buying from someone who's not Jewish, then it requires tefillah. In fact, it's one of the things that I like to make fun of, which is some people are exceedingly, exceedingly machmir. So when it comes to Pesach, it's not enough to sell their chametz to a non-Jew. They decide to sell their kelim as well. There's only one little problem. If you sell your kelim to a non-Jew, then when you buy them back after Pesach, you have to immerse them in the mikveh again. So, moral of the story is, don't be such a machmir here. Just sell your chametz, don't sell your kelim. Right? Your china doesn't matter, but all your silverware and your drinking glasses and everything else would require tevilah again. So even when you sell it to a non-Jew, even if he never even uses it, when you sell it and it changes ownership, you bring it back, it would require tevilah. Okay.
Your point is a presumption. If it's a corporation or something.
What's that?
If it's a corporation that's manufacturing it, and you buy it from a corporation.
I think we assume that if you were to ask me, even though we would like halacha to recognize corporations, I think halacha fundamentally doesn't. It recognizes an amalgamation of individuals. So if the corporation were, if the corporation were majority non-Jewish owned, then it's a non-Jewish ownership of the kli. If the corporation is majority Jewish owned, then I would say it's then it does not require a tefillah.
You assume in Israel you're okay, and in the United States you're not.
Well, yes and no. I remember like 25 years ago we went to Israel and we bought these, the colored glass, and we thought, great, and we don't have to do the tefillah to get back. And then when we took it home, we looked at the bottom, it said made in France, so it might have been painted in Israel. But in such a case, yes, in principle, if it's made, if you're buying in Israel something manufactured in Israel, it's probably at least based upon rope, it's probably going to be Jewish owned from the start. Gabe?
What status of the food cooked in?
doesn't, the food is kosher. The Gemara will say, and Tosus will point out, we'll see the Gemara later, and Tosus points out, doesn't matter what you hold generally about certain issues. If you may not be allowed to use the kli, you may not be allowed to cook in the pot, but if you did, the food is still kosher. That, there's no question about it. It's really a mitzvah saseh to do tefillah on your kelim before you use it in preparation of food. Okay, so now the Gemara says the following: Maskif l'Rav Sheshes. If that is your argument, ihachi afila zuza desar balanami. You're telling me a new vessel requires tefillah, so even a pair of hair cutters, you know, shears to cut the hair, that should require tefillah as well. So, in other words, if it has nothing to do with the food that was used in it, so why is there a distinction between one kind of kli and another? So, Amar Lei, kli suda amurim b'parsha. The parsha is talking about kli suda. The Torah describes these things require fire in order to kasher them. These things require boiling water in order to kasher them. And they require tefillah. But the only things that are in the first two categories are things that are used, that come in contact with the food, that are used for preparing food. So the same thing is true. Even though tefillas kelim is not about getting out any of the non-kosher absorptions and any of the things that might flavor the food you cook in it, nonetheless, it still is limited to what's called clay su'uda. The Gemara itself does not explore any further what clay su'uda are, but one of the interesting things is that storage vessels are technically do not require tevila. So if you have, let's say, a cookie jar or a flour jar, so that assumes glass jar, and glass or metal we'll see in a moment, so that actually doesn't require tevila. If somehow you will machmir to do so, you should certainly do it without a bracha. It has to be things that either are used to transform the food at a later stage, I'll explain that in a moment, or things that are actually used betoch hasuda to eat the food. So the me'ikar hadin, even though I think the Rama is machmir, I haven't looked at this in a long time, a shechita knife doesn't require tevila because it's used it's not really at the end stage preparations of the food. But really what would require tevila would be the pots and their lids, and the dishes that you eat on if they're glass. I mean, most people are thinking about, you know, metal dishes, and the cutlery that you use to eat the food with, and the glasses that you drink from. That is what actually requires tevila. So that's what the definition of clay su'uda is. Okay, so then, Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Bar Avua, Lo Shanu Ela Belekuchim. It only applies, Marshall. So I think the grates require tevila, because that's like a pot, right? It's holding the food while it's on the fire.
Now, I assume that there's no such thing as too late. So I'm guessing many people.
Correct. Correct. In other words, the mitzvah remains in effect. You're not supposed to use it for food until you've done tefila, but if you haven't, there's still a mitzvah to do tefila. Yeah.
Position on things like water urns and things like that.
I think this I mentioned last week. So there are different approaches to this of how you deal. No, it's worth. I didn't give a full. Let me give kind of several approaches then suggested. So I personally follow Rav Shechter, who says that if you can't do tefillah on a clay, so you're potter from doing tefillah. It's a mitzvah saseh. It doesn't make the food aser. We don't say it's not an issur to use it to prepare food with it. You haven't toveled it. It's that there's a mitzvah saseh to do tefillah on it, and if you're able to do tefillah by using it with food before you've done so, you're being mevatel the mitzvah. But if you can't do the mitzvah, then you're honest. You're basically in the category of someone who's not capable of doing it. It's not your choice, and therefore you can just use it as is. There are those who wanted to argue, I don't really buy this, that electric things that are plugged into the wall are considered mechubar lekarka, and something that is attached to the ground, mechubar lekarka, doesn't have the status of a kli, and therefore doesn't require tevila. So I'm not sure I really buy the idea that just because it's used when it's plugged in, that makes it mechubar lekarka. That's not really attached, but okay, they're those who say that. Rav Moshe Feinstein, but this would not work with like the new urns. It would work with the very plain like metal urns. His suggestion was, which this I mentioned last week, was the following, which was to take it to a handyman, a craftsman. He should drill a hole in the bottom and then patch the hole up, you know, solder it closed. And the reason for that was that once you buy the vessel, and now if he drills a hole in it, it's no longer a kli. It's no longer usable. Now when he fixes it, it becomes a kli in the ownership of a Jew when the Jew already owns it, and that doesn't require tevila. Okay. There are a lot of interesting things where Moshe had, he had a very interesting leniency. Rav Schachter doesn't like this, so the firm guys at YU, when they drink the Snapple, they don't drink it out of the bottle. But Rav Moshe said that, like, if you buy a jar of food, when you finish the food, you do not require tefillah if you want to reuse the kli, because his argument was that when you buy, the jars are generally intended to be disposed of. And therefore, when you decide to keep it after you've consumed the food, you're the one who's effectively making it into a vessel, into a kli. And since it's turning into a kli in a Jew's possession, therefore it doesn't require tefillah. Rav Schachter doesn't agree with...
Drinking out of it, why? Because it was made by a guy...
Correct, and it's a kli. It's holding the stuff. So you can't... Obviously, it's nothing you can do... You can't do anything before, but to drink out of it means you're, you know, you would, one would even say that if you just pour it out of there, it's a storage vessel. But if you're going to drink out of it, so then that's clay su'uda. And therefore they do that. My solution is I don't drink Snapple, so I don't have a problem.
What about the tin containers?
You mean the paper, aluminum foil? Yeah. So the assumption, I think where Moshe may say this is that aluminum foil is disposable. It's not, doesn't have a shame clay for these purposes.
Not the foil, but the...
The pans, aluminum foil pans. I don't mean the. But there are lots of different shapes. Yes, Aaron.
Saying that disposable doesn't need tefillah.
Does not require tefillah.
Why would the Snapple bottle need tefillah?
Well, no. The difference is the Snapple bottle is solidly built. You could use that. You know, the tradition was not with Snapple bottles, but you know the Yahrzeit lamps. Okay. The tradition. You grew up in the Lower East Side 50 years ago. That's how you got your glasses for you when you got married. You collected the cleaned out Yahrzeit lamps. But aluminum foil is, you know, is pretty flimsy.
So let's say we know today they have disposable plates that can actually be reused if you so choose to do so.
Right.
So those are substantially, they're much more substantial.
Yeah, but what are they made out of? They're made of plastic. So plastic doesn't require tefillah. But yes, if you had something like that were hypothetically glass or metal, it would be the same thing, I think, as the question of the jar. I think that's what Ramosha would say, that if your Ramosha would say that since it's intended to be disposed of, that intent is sufficient, whereas I think Schefter would probably say no, that you shouldn't use it because it is really fundamentally reusable. So, okay. All right, so now the Gemara continues. Amar Rav Nachman, Amar Rabba Bar Avuha, Lo Shanu Ela Balakuchim. The requirement of the Mishnah to do tefillah only applies if you buy it. And like the story in Midian, namely, they conquered the Midianites, they killed the Midianites, they took the Midianites' kelim, and they became their own. Aval she'ulam lo. But if you borrow a kli, then there's no requirement to see. If you borrow a non-Jew's kli, let's say you borrow a drinking glass, or he bought a new pot, and the stickers are still on it, and you can see that, and he lends you his pot to cook in, so you're allowed to, you can use it without, you don't need to do tevila on it. This comes up, this is a very important issue in terms of Bishas HaTchak. I mentioned this last week. A student of mine asked me a shayla that in his shul, they couldn't get access to the mikveh. They had some new kalim, and the mikveh hours, even though he's the rabbi, the mikveh hours were apparently so limited, he and his wife would not be home in order to take care of it. And he asked if they could, and the answer was yes. Can they, in the interim, until they can get it to the mikveh, can they give it to a non-Jew, to be machne to a non-Jew temporarily, so that it's a non-Jew's kli, so they could use it, and then when they finally have access to the mikveh, then they'll take it back from the Gentile and do tefillah on it. And that is an eitzah that suggested. This comes up, actually, I think the Rush in Maseches Beitza talks about... on Yom Tov, so you're not allowed to do tevilah if kelim become tamei, they become ritually impure. You're not allowed to tovel them on Shabbos or Yom Tov because midrabanan, it's like fixing a kli. So normally, fixing to be a malacha daraisa, it has to be physically fixing. But here, this is metaphysically fixing the kli. The kli was tamei. You're going to immerse it. You're going to make it tahor. That transformation is considered tikkun mana, fixing a kli midrabanan on Shabbos or Yom Tov. So the Gemara talks about it in the context of Tumah V'Tahara, when you have a kli that became ritually impure. Obviously, that's irrelevant to us today. But what happens if you have a kli that you haven't done Tfilas Kelim on, what we call Tfilas Klei Midyan, Klei Suda, that you want to use to eat? So the Rush, the Gemara doesn't say anything, but the Rif and the Rush both say that the same prohibition applies to it, that you're transforming the vessel into something that you can't really use for food preparation to something that you can use. And even though it's not a physical transformation, nonetheless, it is prohibited, at least rabbinically. So I believe that the Rush there quotes the suggestion, the advice, that if you didn't do tefillah before Yom Tov and you want to use the kelim, you should give it to a non-Jew temporarily, and then you can use it without doing tefillah, and then you eventually when you take it back, when you retake possession of it, you will then immerse it in a mikvah. Okay. So now, Rav Yitzchak bar Yosef, Zvan Mana de Marda me Oved Kochavim. So he bought a vessel of, it was an earthen vessel. It wasn't even, not even clear, it was earthenware. Rashi says it was a Kli Adama, mixed, it was made with dirt and with dried, I guess, cattle dung, mixed together, meaning it wasn't made from metal or glass, as we'll see in a second. And Savar Lahatbila, he thought that he would go Tovel in the mikveh. So Amar Le'ahume Rabbanan, that rabbi, that one of the rabbi's students, Rabbi Yaakov Shimei, said to him, no, L'didi Mifarshali Minei de Rabbi Yochanan. I have a tradition. Rabbi Yochanan explained to us where the obligation of doing tefillah actually applies. Klei matchus amurim b'parsha. The Torah only speaks about metal kelim. And I mentioned last time, some say that it's limited to the six metals mentioned in the Torah. It wouldn't apply to, let's say, aluminum. So if you did tefillah on aluminum, I would tell you, we probably do tefillah on aluminum, but do it without a bracha, because it's not clear it's obligated in tefillah. Only gold, copper, gold, silver, copper, iron, lead and tin, probably you're not using lead anyway, we hope, require tefillah, for sure, and that you make a bracha, but if you were doing aluminum, you would do it without a bracha.
Do you consider stainless steel iron?
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is iron. Right? I mean, it's, however it's been, you know, machined or processed and so on, but it's iron.
How is your whole piping system?
Well, that I'll agree is mechuber lekarka. Okay, that I think we can establish pretty well. Yeah, that doesn't bother me. That I'm not convinced that something you plug into the wall is considered mechuber. Your pipes are mechuber. That I go for. Okay. Amar Ravashi. Now Ravashi comes along and says, "Hani klei zechuches, these glass kelim, hovel v'chi nishtabru, yesh lahem takana kiklima, since if glass breaks, it can be melted down and refashioned, therefore, kiklimat chustamu. They are treated like metal kelim." So many, this is a debate amongst the Rishonim. Some Rishonim understand that the obligation to immerse metal kelim is a Torah requirement, whereas the obligation to immerse glass is only a rabbinic requirement based upon Ravashi said, and since glass kind of looks like metal, because if it breaks, you can melt it down the same way if a metal kli broke, therefore, it requires tefillah. So that's how some understand, and others understand that the entire obligation of immersing kelim for eating is actually only rabbinic in nature. Yeah. But certainly, everybody agrees that the obligation on glass is rabbinic in nature, and I mentioned the practical difference, the nafka mina I mentioned last week, is that can you give a katan, a minor, the vessel to take to the kelim mikvah? If the obligation is d'oraisa, if it's Torah's obligation, the answer is no, because the katan isn't believed, technically, that he or she immersed it in the mikvah. Whereas if the obligation is only rabbinic, so certainly it applies to glass, then you should be able to give it to a minor, a katan, to do so. Yes, absolutely. There are some signs in some mikvahs. Sometimes you get contradicting signs. No bracha on glass. That's a complete error. Yes, Gabe.
What exactly is this reason that since it breaks, you can melt it down? Because you can melt down anything. So
wood. You can't do it to wood. You can't do it to earthenware.
I've heard plastic. I can melt that down.
Plastic was not a substance known to them. If they were around, Maybe it would have been the case. Maybe they would have been gozer on it. They might have made xera, but they didn't. But their other vessels were wood and earthenware, and they had leather used in wine flasks and other kinds of things that really were not subject to melting down. And if you look, it's true not only here. When it comes to issues of Tumah v'Tahara, ritual impurity, so glass is not mentioned in the Torah, and it min haTorah, it is not susceptible to receiving Tumah. But midrabanan, they created that. And if you look at the laws of glass vessels, it's kind of a hybrid between earthenware, because it's made from earth, from sand, and metal, because it can be refashioned the way metal can be refashioned. An earthenware vessel, when you want to get rid of the Tumah, you break it, because you can't refashion it. It's no longer a vessel. It's no longer a kli, like Ramosha's drilling a hole in the metal urn. But metal, and because glass can be refashioned like metal, in some ways they treat it like, it's a hybrid in terms of its treatment. So here, Ravashi's statement is not a surprise here. It's not a surprise that he says, you know what, throw glass into the pot here, because we do something, the Mishnah does something very similar. Again, there it's a hybrid by Tuma Vitara. Here you can't have a hybrid because earthenware vessels don't require Tvila. So the only question is, will you treat it like metal because it has metal-like aspects or not? Glass is never. Nobody holds that way. Only metal is the debate. But everybody agrees that glass is only the Rabbana. Okay. Fine. So now, Kunya. Kunya is earthenware vessel covered, plated with lead. So the question is, does this kli require immersion? Because on the one hand, the basic body of the vessel is earthenware, is china, and it's exempt. On the other hand, the coating that comes in contact with the food is metal. So the Gemara says, Kunya, narrow line in the Gemara at the end, Kunya. Pligi ba Ravacha v'Ravina. Ravacha and Ravina argue about this. Chad amar k'tchilaso v'chad amar k'sofa. One said that you follow the sort of the core of the kli, and that's earthenware, it's an exempt, and the other one says you follow the end product. We would probably say the part that comes in contact with the food. V'hilchasa, and how do we paskin? So the Gemara says k'sofa. So I believe if you look in Shulchan Aruch, I think the Mechaber just paskin straight like this, but the Ramah is machmir. He's machmir on both sides of the equation. When you have something where the inside is metal, let's say, and the outside is something else, so that, he assumes, requires immersion. But he also assumes, let's say you have the way you might have a barrel made, a wooden barrel, except that there are metal rings around it that hold it together. So I think the Ramah is stringent, is machmir there. You do tvila, you immerse it without a bracha, because the metal is what we call a davar hama'amid. It's something that actually holds the vessel up, and it allows it to function, and therefore we're concerned that maybe it's treated like a metal vessel. The concept does exist elsewhere. The Gemara says that if you have an earthenware vessel that got a hole in it and it's no longer usable as is, and it loses its ritual impurity and it's not susceptible either. So, but if you fill in the hole with lead, even though the lead itself standalone wouldn't be any kind of a vessel, it now becomes a lead kli and it's makabel tuma. Why? Because that is the davar hamamid. It kind of holds it together. It keeps it together. So the Ramah is actually stringent on both sides of the equation. Okay. So, but usually when we, like if someone will ask, let's say, about a blender or something like that, we'll tell him, at least the metal parts that are removable, the blade and things like that, require tevila. The parts that don't have any metal in them when they're separable parts don't require tevila. Okay. Ibai Elihu, the Gemara asks the following question. Mashkanta mai. What happens if a non-Jew gives a Jew a kli, a vessel, as a mashkon? The Jew, it's something known from the Middle Ages, the non-Jew borrowed money from the Jew. And the Jew took a security, took a pledge. And they always took pledges. It was a bad idea not to take a pledge. In fact, some of you, I don't think she ever spoke at KJ on this, but my wife she has another man in her life. Fortunately, he's been dead about 800 years. His name was Herman. I call him Herman the German, Herman of Cologne. It's an autobiography. He was a mishumad. He was an apostate. He converted to Christianity. But the story of how he converted to Christianity was he loaned money. He was a teenager. He was helping in the family business. And he loaned some, I don't know, it was a bishop or a Christian, maybe it was a Christian, in some town money. And he didn't take a pledge. And his father told him, you have to go live there and wait for the non-Jew to pay you back the loan, because you have to be on top of him. And he ended up going there, and he lived there, and the kindness of the bishop, and so on, and so on and so forth. That's how he became an apostate. So Jews typically took mashkonos from non-Jews. So the question is, what's the status of it? If the Jew is going to use it, let's assume sometimes it's assumed you're going to use a mashkon, you're allowed to use a mashkon. So the question is, who does that belong to? Now, this is, generally speaking, a very interesting issue in halacha, not related to our topic, but what is the status of a mashkon in general when you take a pledge? Because if you think about it, the Torah says that if you have a poor person and you take a pledge, so you have to return it every night or every day. And the Torah says that ulechati etzdaka, it will be considered a merit, a righteous thing of yours. And the Gemara concludes from that, at least it may be in some context, that balchov kone mashkon, that a balchov actually takes ownership of a mashkon, because if he didn't, what's the big tzedakah? You're giving him back his own thing to use. And that's the way to go. It's a very complicated sugya, and where exactly it applies, but there's certainly, what's underlying the discussion there, is the question of, do you acquire partial ownership of a mashkon? Clearly, it's not yours completely. How do I know that? Because if the guy comes and pays back the loan, you have to give him back the mashkon. It's not your choice to keep it. So the question is, what is the status of a mashkon before the loan has been paid off, when the Jew is holding it? Does it have the status of a non-Jewish kli, or does it have the status right now of a Jewish kli? So Amar Mar Bar Rav Ashi, Abba Mishke no Ove Kochavim Kasa de Kaspa, Ve'at Bele Ve'ishte Be. So a non-Jew gave my father as a mashkon a silver cup, and my father immersed it and then drank from it. Now, the question is, why did he have to immerse it? V'lo yadana imishum dekasavar mashkanta kizvine damya, that it's like buying it. In other words, a mashkon is like the person who receives the mashkon has ownership. Or imishum dechazi la'ove kochavim dedate l'shakue. Or is it because my father saw, he realized this non-Jew, he wasn't going to redeem it. He wasn't going to pay back the loan. He was going to let my father just keep the silver coast. My father would sell it. But, in theory, if it were the latter possibility, so it might have been, that if he didn't in the end, that if, in fact, he assumed the non-Jew did have the intent of actually paying the loan back and getting the coast, then it wouldn't require tefillah because it wouldn't actually belong to the Jew. Marshall.
So, one question is, whose law of security actually applies to this question? For example, if secular law applies, in the United Kingdom, when you actually do a mortgage, a transfer actually titles, the title to the property actually transfers to the bank.
I thought isn't that true here too?
It's not true here. The homeowner has a right of repurchase, that's true, but it's not relevant. In the U.S. system, when you have a mortgage, you remain the owner of record. They hold the deed as collateral, have the right to foreclose, and seek to have the deed transferred to themselves.
Uh-huh.
So if non-Jewish law applies, you actually get a different answer on much.
So my assumption would be that in the context of, I think everybody would agree, that when dealing with a transaction between a Jew and a non-Jew, that Dina Malchus Adina governs. It could be that even sometimes between Jew and Jew, Dina the Malchusa Dina may govern if it's a contractual issue, and the assumption of the parties is that they're just working under Dina Malchusa Dina. But I think with a Jew and a non-Jew, everybody would agree under a non-Jewish a Jewish government, everybody I think would agree that it's governed by Dina the Malchusa.
Because the Gemara doesn't seem to admit of the possibility that they're all asking the wrong question, which is it's actually a question of secular law as to how a mashkanta is treated.
Right, so I suspect, you don't know. In other words, the Gemara says mashkanta kizvine damu. It doesn't say specify under which system of law they're thinking. They could also be thinking about dina malchus adina. So that is possible. The Gemara doesn't. I drew an analogy just to elsewhere in halacha, which is clearly between two Jews, that the status of a mashkon is unclear. But it could be part of what's clouding the discussion is the application of how Persian law might have dealt with this. Again, I don't know how it dealt with a Jew and a non-Jew, and I don't know if it applied this sort of broader law or it recognized internal Jewish law in some cases, you know, depending upon who was the recipient of the mashkon and so on. I don't know. One interesting question the Gemara doesn't explore here, but which is really actually kind of fascinating, is when did Rav Ashi do the tevila? In other words, take the following scenario. Supposing a Gentile lends me his kli. And right now my assumption is that he's going to take it back. And I decide I'm going to be a frumer, and I'm going to do tefillah on it anyway. I don't want to rely upon, you know, these leniencies of these, you know, not so from Amoraim. So I'm going to do tefillah on this clay. Okay, and now I do tefillah, fine. And now a week later, the guy says, you know what? You want to keep the clay? I don't really need it. And I say, great. So I would say you have to do tefillah then. Because the tefillah that you did earlier doesn't actually work. Because it still belonged to a non-Jew and there was no intent. Now that he decides that he's giving it to you or selling, whatever it is, now it requires tefillah. Now you can actually immerse in the mikvah. Now the question is, what when he said, maybe my father saw that his intent was not to reacquire it, so what exactly does that mean? Meaning, Rav Ashi saw that, yeah, he's not going to, is that what it meant? Or Rav Ashi understood from him, in other words, it's not just that he thought that Rav Ashi saw that it wasn't just that he sensed that the non-Jew was probably going to leave with him, is that the non-Jew already told him, I'm leaving it with you. It's a little, it doesn't sound like that from the Gemara, but if in fact it's just that Rav Ashi intuited that he was likely to leave it, so if the guy could still change his mind, so why should Rav Ashi's tefillah work? Unless the answer might be that he did do tefillah again. In other words, he did tefillah initially because it looked like the guy was probably going to leave it with him, so he was already concerned. So it's not a regular mashkon, but at the end of the day, when the guy decides, yeah, you know what, okay, I'm done, Rav Ashi might have done tefillah again. Okay?
I'm going to say that you retroactively acquired it from the time of giving the love.
So I don't think that's true with a mashkon. But maybe I'm wrong. I want to think back for a second. What's the case? Oh, wait, there's a whole discussion. It's a machlokas in the Gemara Pesachim, actually, about this issue. Whether when a Baal Chov is Gova, and it's dealing with a case of chametz that was given as a mashkon, it's a chametz and Pesach question. Mikanu l'habahu Gova or l'mafreyahu Gova? It's a machlokas there. I don't remember how we paskin. So you're saying that if you hold paskin the mafreya who gova, that the collection of the mashkon as payment is retroactive, then it should be fine. Yeah. Okay, that's true. I think that's correct. Okay. So that's really prime. This is the end of the discussion of tefilas kelim, and now we move on to the discussion of hagolas kelim and hechsher kelim. We do libum, we do hagolah, etc. So now the Gemara begins with the brisa. Tanu rabbanan. Third, at the end of the third wide line in the Gemara, halokeach kli tashmish mina oved kochavim. If you buy a kli that is used for food from the non-Jew, dvarim shelo nishtamish bahem, if they're new, the non-Jew hasn't used it at all, matbilan, you immerse it in the mikvah, vehein tahorim, and everything's good. You can use them however you want to use them. Dvarim shenishtamish bahem ayidei tzonein, if he used it with cold stuff, then, one second, screw my students, I keep the finger on the place, but I lost my spot here. Kigon, kosos, kitonios, utslochios, pitchers and cups, madichon, umatbilon, vehem tahorim. You have to rinse them out because there might be non-kosher stuff in it, but the kli is not going to have absorbed the non-kosher stuff because it was cold. And that would be sufficient. I'm sorry, tzolchus would be, a plate.
Yeah.
Why would I assume it's only cold? So there are two possibilities here. One is to say that it was a particular type of thing that was only used cold. The other possibility is when you use a plate, it always is considered halachically as cold because how do you get stuff on a plate, on salads on a plate?
From a hot pot. This is the ladle itself is a cliche.
Well, no, let's assume it's a plate. Now, let's not assume soup for the moment. But yeah, let's keep it simple. Let's take a piece of meat. I take a piece of meat, I take it out of the pot, now, and I put it on a plate. What's the status of the plate, the meat? So the Shulchan Aruch paskins, it's a cliche already, which is considered for these purposes cold.
Why would the plate be a cliche?
What's that?
If you're transferring it. I thought you would say as far as the tongs is the cliche and the
Well, it's you could say that if you want. Let's take again meat where you just take a fork. I don't want to get into the whole ladle question. You could call cliche or cliche. Let's assume the way the Ramah does, at least post facto that neither cliché nor cliché does not absorb. So that's effectively cold. The complicated part about it is that there is a machlokas here, there is a position of the Maharshal that many of the Achronim are stringent for, which is that when you're dealing with, let's say, a solid piece of food, even when you take it out of the Kli Rishon and put it on a plate, it's still considered a Kli Rishon. It's based upon a misreading of Tosos. It might be correct anyway, logically, but they quote Tosos in Shabbos asks a question, why is a cliché any different than a Kli Rishon? Why should there be any difference? So the way the Achronim, including the Shach, misquote Tosos is they say that Tosos says that the reason why a Kli Sheni does not cook is because its walls cool down the food. The Phanos are Mekaros. That's actually not what Tosos says. Tosos says that the reason why a Kli Rishon cooks is because it has the Phanos HaMechamamos. Its walls continue to heat the food. Now, the difference between those two formulations, obviously, is a solid food that doesn't require walls, that doesn't come in contact with the walls, in the Kli Sheni. Right? But the argument of the Maharshal, again, I've never seen the Maharshal, the original, is that since there are no walls to cool down the piece of meat because it never comes in contact with the walls, therefore, a hot piece of meat that's still Yad Soledes, that's still hot enough to burn you, on the plate, is considered a Kli Rishon right there. The Mechaber and the Ramah do not accept the Maharshal, but many Achronim and Kashrus organizations are Machmir for this.
So it's like a Kuliyama that you can't Kashur China plates?
Well, that's only if they've absorbed hot. If they're cold, you just rinse them.
Right, but didn't you just finish saying that this whole svara rests on the fact that a plate can never be considered a Kli Sheni that absorbs hot?
Right, so in other words, the Gemara, this type of plate is not used with hot. Whatever the reason is, because they don't put hot food on it, or because you don't hold to the Maharshal and it's a plate used for solids or something like that, which are hot, but it's not halachically hot. So this has to be something that doesn't absorb. However it gets to, because these plates contain a warning, do not use with hot foods, may shatter, or because you just don't, or because you use it for solids and you don't hold like this stringency of the Maharshal, whatever it is, assume that these stolchios are things that are not used with, this is all cold stuff, right? The Gemara says, things that are darker l'shtamish
b'tzonin. How do you get it from the pot to the plate? You have to use something every single time. So anything that you put hot on a plate is not hot.
If you poured a liquid out of a pot, or maybe even if you, even technically speaking, if you took the meat pot, and this is not the way we normally do it, and you sort of, not today, typically, yes. You're more likely to do that into once upon a time, even today, into a serving platter than onto somebody's plate on the table. But yeah, the answer is, unless you hold to the Maharshal's Chumrah, which there's a tendency to do so, plates are not ever going to be one thing or another. That's correct. Yes, that is correct. Without the Chumrah of the Maharshal,
one and
Oh, please. It's the logic of the Maharshal is not crazy, actually. It makes a lot of sense.
No, for sure. And by the way, when you're barbecuing, just to give you the counter example, you all the time slide meat directly onto plates.
I don't. I barbecue a lot.
We don't have to resolve this issue now. But the bottom line is the primary, unless you're pouring a liquid, you know, from a pot, again, bowls, China bowls are more possible. There are probably occasions where you might pour from a small pot, you know, directly, but a plate is much harder unless you hold to the Maharshal's Chumrah. It is, I think, yeah, plates are generally going to be only a Kli Sheni. By the way, that Kli Sheni itself is a debate, but the Ramah is lenient, I'd be the evidence that a Kli Sheni doesn't absorb. That's a questionable position. The Rashba's position, which is seems to be much more logically compelling, is that a Kli Sheni doesn't cook, but it doesn't mean that no absorptions take place. So it requires certain constructions to get to a plate becoming treif.
So it's always sonin. So there's no issue of milk or meat. You can actually
correct
use anything on this.
Well, listen, I don't know that they practically do it, but maybe they do. But if you were smarty and you held that glass never absorbs year round nor Pesach and so on, you could keep one set of dishes. Period. We're not. Most of us are not smarty, so we don't have that leniency. So we wind up needing at least four sets of plates. That's if we don't want to have China and Kura. So whatever. Okay. All right, so those are the cold things. Madichan umatbilan vehem tahorim. So you rinse them, You do tefillah now, because that's nothing to do with kosher, non-kosher food, and everything's ready to use. Dvarim shenishtamish b'mayirei chamin. If you use something that was used with hot liquids as the medium, kigon hayoros hakum kumusim u'mechamei chamin, these are various kinds of kettles or pots, magilan u'madbilan v'heim tahorim. Then you have to do hagala, which means to immerse it in boiling water, because the rule is kibol o kach polto. The way it absorbs, the way it swallows the food, is the way it emits the food, the way it spits it out. And finally, dvarim shenishtamish behem ayidei ha'or, kigon hashpudin v'haskalos, things that were used directly on the fire with the food, with no liquid medium, like a spit, like a grate, milabnon, you do libun on it, then umat bilan, then you do tefillah in the mikvah with it, and vehein tahorim, and then you're allowed to use them. Now, one point that I think is really important to keep in mind is that there's a fundamental distinction between hagala and libun. Hagala is the way it's understood mechanically or chemically, actually is extracting or removing the blios from wherever they were absorbed or attached. Libun is this, and libun, at least in the Gemara, is assumed to be libun chamor, something like the temperature of a self-cleaning oven. And libun destroys the blios, the absorptions, wherever they are. That matters in a number of different contexts. For starters, earthenware vessels, you cannot kasher through hagala. The Gemara says in a couple of places that the Torah speaks about when you cook a karbanos, when you cook sacrifices, which are going to become nosar, they're going to become leftover, you can't eat them after a day in the night, or whatever it is, that when the Torah says that if you cook a karban shlamin in an earthenware vessel, you have to break the vessel. And the assumption is because you can't reuse it because of that which it absorbed. Now, copper vessels, the Torah says, you can do some process of purifying through water. Umorak vishutaf b'mayim. That's what the Torah says. So the Gemara understands that HaTorah he'ina al klecheres she'ina yotzei midei dofya la'olam. The Torah has testified here about earthenware vessels that you can never fully extract the absorptions. That's why the Torah says you have to break it. Now, what about, so you can't do hagala. You can't put the earthenware vessels in a boiling water. But what about doing libun? What about using a blowtorch on an earthenware vessel? So the Gemara Pesachim says, effectively, in effect, the answer is yes, you can. But the only way to do it, they don't allow you to do regular libun because they're afraid you won't do a good enough job because you're afraid that the earthenware is going to break. So, but if you put it back in the kiln, if you machzir l'kivshonos, so then you can kasher it that way. That's what the Gemara says. And our modern equivalent that Poskim have said is a self-cleaning oven. If you receive a set of china, you know, very valuable china, and but it's not kosher, and you want to, you know, you want to see if you could use it, one way of doing it, if it won't destroy it, is to put it in a self-cleaning oven. And if the china will survive that, then you can kosher the china that way. The recommendation generally, Marshall, is to test it on one piece first before putting other pieces in. If it can handle the temperature, that's like Masa the Kivshonos, and the china will be, you can kosher china.
You know, I remember many years ago, someone told us, if you know it hasn't been used for more than a year.
So Ramosha has a tshuva. Ramosha, there would have been another, there was another very interesting machlokes harishonim about another way around the problem. There is a Yerushalmi that says, it's quoted by the Baal HaItor, one of the, I think, Provençal Rishonim, probably 13th century. The Baal HaItor, or 12th century, the Baal HaItor quotes a Yerushalmi that says that if you have something that is only rabbinically prohibited in an earthenware vessel, you can do Hagala three times and you can use it. Okay, you can do it three times. Now, that's what the Yerushalmi says. Talmud Bavli doesn't talk about this at all. The Baal HaItor quotes this, and now he makes a leap. He makes the following extension. As we mentioned before, and we'll see on the bottom of this page, and if we'll get there today, if you have a vessel that hasn't been used for 24 hours, you have a kli she'eino benyomo, so we say that you're not allowed to cook in it, it's a rabbinic gezeira, but any food you cooked in it will be kosher, unless it's sharp food. We say that a kli after 24 hours does not enhance the absorptions, now are detrimental to the food that you're cooking in as a general rule. It's no saint tam lifgam. It damages the food or it detracts at least a little bit. And therefore the food cooked in non-kosher vessels that weren't used for 24 hours will be kosher. Okay. Not allowed to do it, but the food doesn't make the food treif. So the Bala Itur says the following. He says that if you have an earthenware vessel, even if it absorbed, tarfus, glat treif, it absorbed, wait 24 hours, and now the absorptions are only rabbinic, the prohibition is only rabbinic in nature. After 24 hours, do Hagala three times, and it should be fine.
What's the three times? Why?
That's what the Yerushalmi says. I don't know, maybe because Hagala, you know, the Bala Eter himself, by the way, is an aside, I don't know if it's in this context, claims that the fact that you can't kasher earthenware is only a din derabbanan. It's only rabbinic. I don't know if these two, I don't know if they're related, I'm not sure that they're related at all. But anyway, but the Yerushalmi says it is talking about Truma, which is only rabbinic in nature. However you get Truma that's only rabbinic in nature, you can do Hagala three times. And the Bala Eter says, look, after 24 hours, the prohibition of using the vessel is only midrabanan, therefore you can do Hagala three times. The Rashba cites this in his Torah Sabayis. The Beis Yosef quotes this Rashba, but then he quotes back the Rashba said that the two may not be perfectly analogous. There might be a difference between something which is absorbed in a pot when the whole prohibition is rabbinic in the first place versus something that was a Torah prohibition when it was absorbed, but now has turned into a rabbinic prohibition. What the Beis Yosef doesn't tell you is that at the end the Rashba thinks the Bala Itur is right. But the Mechaber doesn't accept it. The Mechaber and Shulchan Aruch, we don't accept that leniency alone. But Rav Moshe has a tshuva, speaking about Bali tshuva, and the concern, you know, that it's hard for them and they might have things that are, you know, have either financial or very strong emotional pull. So Rav Moshe puts together a number of different minority opinions. One of them is this Bala Itur. Another is this, the idea of leaving the Kalim for 12 months, which really only appears, we saw it last week, by Yayin Nesach. It doesn't really appear as a way of kashering Kalim. I don't know if he had anything else, if he had one other sort of tzad, one other path. So he puts them all together and says that in these cases, you could do the Hagala three times, you know, for someone who's about Shuba, so they could keep, you know, the Kalim that they had. But as a straight outright issue, things that absorb through heat, we don't assume that you can do leave them 12 months and that they can be used. Okay. So that is that is the difference between Limun and Hagala. One other example where the issue comes up is only relevant to Ashkenazim. Ashkenazim are very machmir on Pesach. Sfarim are machmir, but they can't hold a candle to Ashkenazim on this. And one of the chumrah, what's that? Okay. And one of the chumras that Ashkenazim have is that you cannot do Hagalah on Pesach after Pesach, the first night begins. Theoretically, it's possible in the certain circumstances to do Hagala after the time you can no longer eat chametz until sundown of the first day of Pesach. It's theoretically possible, but once Pesach comes, it's impossible to do Hagala. The reason it's impossible to do Hagala is because Hagala, in theory, always relies upon bittul of nullifying the iser. Because theoretically, when you do Hagala, you are extracting the absorptions. They come into the water. The water, I don't want to go through the details now. We might touch upon it on the next amud, not today. Somehow it works through the process of bittul, of having enough water against the absorptions and whatever else. That's the process. And since Ashkenaz and Paskin, there's no bittul for chametz on Pesach, even when it's no Saint Tam of Gam, even after 24 hours from the kli, you know, the chametz is already pogum, there's no bittul. Therefore, we cannot do Hagala once Pesach has started. But Libun you can do, because Libun doesn't rely upon bittul. Libun is consuming and annihilating the prohibited substance, material, wherever it happens to be located. So Libun and Hagala are the two kinds of things that we use here for kashering kalim, but they work through two totally different methods. One by extracting that which is absorbed, using the same method of absorption for extraction. Libun is destroying it wherever it happens to be.
Probably just a technical yes. question. When you do Libun, do you have to do both sides of the pot, let's say?
Theoretically, you shouldn't have to, because however far it gets through the normal process, you're applying the Libun that way. I think, if I'm not mistaken, the Gemara, I think it may be explicit, the Gemara in Pesachim on Daf Lamed on the Beis actually says that. When they talk about kashering earthenware by putting it back and where you can and where you can't do it, they talk about things that are normally done from the inside versus the outside. So I think it is assumed you only need to do it on the side that typically comes in contact.
You have to do the lip also.
That's true. That would be true.
The water pours over.
All right, so that's a separate, that would be a, right, another question. If your stuff gets on the outside, that's a more interesting question. So I don't know too many. Well, I would say I don't encounter Lieben very much today, other than a self-cleaning oven. But I don't know. I don't know how often people use it anymore. But I'm not sure what kind. I guess we're wealthy enough. We're sufficiently comfortable that most things we just buy something else for Pesach. In my house, certainly, I will not be kashering the grates on the grill for Pesach. That's for sure. So, not by my choice. My children like blowtorches, but that's not happening. Gabe?
Just to end that, school, they do leave it on the entire kitchen. They take a blowtorch before Pesach, and they just...
Right, so I don't think... The truth is, I'm not sure how much any of it is necessary. The oven, you know... The oven, I know what the machlokas will be, but the grates, but that would be the only thing that would require it, at least the Rav Spzak was, and again, Ramosha may not agree with this, that if you use the same temperature to absorb through Libun, then that's sufficient form of Libun for destroying it. In other words, an oven, what we tell people, I think most Rabbanim in our community tell people, let's say you have an oven that's not self-cleaning. So what do you do? So the answer is you can turn the oven to the highest setting it can go. You clean it, the highest setting it can go to, and you leave it there for 45 minutes an hour, whatever it is. If you don't, but that's not full-fledged Libun. That's not what we call Libun Chomer. That's really Libun Kal. Others hold that you need a blowtorch in that example. And we would say the same thing for the grates on the stove. Clean the grates, put a pot on it, and turn it all the way up and leave, you know, a pot with water boiling for 45 minutes, an hour, half an hour, whatever, and you've done enough for the grates. Nothing else should require Libun. Pots are used with liquids. There's a solution to that. It's the last Gemara on the bottom of Ayin Vav and Aleph. You put a lip of clay around the top, leaving just a little exposed. You fill it with boiling water to the top. Well, two ways. And you overfill it that way. Or if you don't do that, because people normally do that, you fill it almost the way top, boil it. You take something else very hot, either a hot stone you put on the fire, or you take boiling water, and you just pour a little in, so it spills over, and you've kashered it. That's the Gemara says. That's how you kashered a pot.
Commercial kitchens now. I mean, right here in Manhattan, the Mashgichim come in a month before they take Pesach.
Oh, yeah. So
and
if you can't,
they do use torches.
Yeah, if you can't move the pot, then you have to do that, I suppose. But in a regular kitchens, I don't know what the kitchen's like there. But in a regular household kitchen, you shouldn't often, unless you're machmir for the.
Maybe it's messier.
I don't know. Whatever. Yes, Marshall.
So if you were very machmir after you bought a messenger to never use it on the highest temperature, like it goes to 550, and it said like you never use it above 540. And then for kashrut, you set it and only for kashrut to 550. Would that actually have a status of Libun Chomer?
No. Libun Chomer is assumed to be a particular temperature. We don't know exactly, but...
It's not a question of being higher than...
Correct. No. There is an absolute standard of it. What's that, Larry?
It's not just Kibolo Kampo.
Correct.
Because right? Then you could just... The highest temperature would work.
Right, right. So that those who don't hold... Right, the argument... The argument against the Rav's leniency is that it's that Libun doesn't work by extracting, so it's not Kabbalah Kapolta. Okay.
Can you put the grates in the self-cleaning oven?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
The same principle.
No. Most right. Manufacturers say no, and the boy.
Right. You're asking. He's asking two different questions. He's asking a halacha question. You're talking about a mitzvah question.
Oh.
Yeah. He was. No. I was. Don't take any practical advice from me. I just give you theoretical advice. Okay. Yes. You know, that's like, you know, the story if we have a friend, you know, the person who builds a sukkah, they follow Shitas Rashi and the sukkah fell down. And so he said, I understand, I followed Rashi, Shitas, built a sukkah. And someone said, yeah, that was Tosis's Kasha. So, all right. So anyway, so now the Gemara, now here comes the really important line in the Gemara, which is, we are five lines from the bottom, near the end of the line. V'chulon shenishtamesh bahem. If you use the vessels... Ad shelo yatbil, v'shelo yagil, v'shelo yilabin. If you didn't do the proper the required preparation, what's the status of the food? Tani chada aser, v'tani idach mutter. There were two brises, one which said the stuff, the food is aser, one which said the food is mutter. So Tosus just comments, the bottom Tosus, that the version of the brisa that says that the food is prohibited is only going on Libun and Hagala. It's not going on Tevila. It's not going on immersion. Everybody would agree, if you don't immerse I mean, it's a new kli, but you didn't put it. You didn't do tefillah. Everybody agrees the food is not actually is not inedible. You know, halachically, you're allowed to use it. But the discussion is really about what if you didn't do liban or you didn't do hagalah. So we have a debate here as to what is whether or not it's permissible to eat the food or not. So what's the basis of the debate? What's the we call the nekudas hamachlokas, the point of departure? So the Gemara says that lo kasha, there's no contradiction. Ha kiman da amar no sein tam lufgam asur. Ha kiman da amar no sein tam lufgam mutar. So we've discussed this issue a little bit back. What happens if non-kosher food falls into kosher food, but the impact of the non-kosher food is it doesn't enhance the food, it detracts somewhat from the food. It doesn't render it inedible, but it doesn't taste as good as it did before. So we paskin that you can consume the food, even though you can taste the non-kosher food, because it is no Saint Tom, it gives flavor, lifgam. But that was a debate between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Shimon earlier in our parak. So the Gemara suggests here that the brisa that's, and the assumption is that when you use a kli that's absorbed non-kosher food, at least after a certain time, the flavor that it imparts is going to be no good. It's going to be pogame. So if you hold that no sein tam lufgam generally is permissible, so then if you use the vessel without doing hagala or without doing libun, the food will still be kosher because it's no sein tam lufgam. If you believe in general that when non-kosher food, you can taste it and it detracts from the flavor, it's still prohibited. So then the food that you cooked in these kalim will be prohibited. So that's what the Gemara says, that hakimah, the brisa that says it's permitted to eat the food if you didn't do liban hagala but you cooked them with the vessels. Hakimah damar no sein tam lufgam is mutter, and hakimah damar no sein tam lufgam is asur. So then the Gemara just asks one basic question, and we've mentioned this many times before. Second to last line, Ulaman da Amar, no sein tam lufgam is mutter. If you believe that something that you can taste the tray food, but it detracts from the flavor, if you hold that it's permitted, Giulei ovde kochavim da asar achmana heichem eshkachasla. Why does the Torah require kashering the kelim they took from Midian in the first place? It would never be asar. Amar achia berei de Rav Huna, lo asra Torah, ela kedera basyoma, de lav no sein tam lufgamu. The Torah only prohibits using a kli that has been used within the last 24 hours with the non-kosher food. That flavor is assumed to still be potentially beneficial. After 24 hours, it will be detrimental. So then the Gemara just asks, if that's the case, the lav amikan ve'elach lishteri. On the top of Ayin Vav Amud Aleph. Why don't we say that after 24 hours, there's a great solution? We could do away with half the kasher and kalim. The only time you need to kasher kalim is when you want to use it within 24 hours. You got a big Sheva Brachos coming up you're making, something happened to one of your kalim, or you want to use the milchik stuff for fleishiks, that's a problem. But if you have a few days go by during the week, so what's the problem? Use the meat kalim for milk. Use the milk kalim for meat, because after all, it's no sein tam lufgam. So the Gemara says that gzeira kedera shena basyoma mishum kedera basyoma. It's a rabbinic decree that if we allow you to use a kli, when it's after the 24 hours, people are going to make a mistake and they'll use it even within the 24 hours. And the Gemara concludes this part with one last note, v'idach, the opinion in Rabbi Meir's opinion, that no sein tam lufgam is prohibited, what would he say? In other words, after all, how can you... why would he say, or what would the basis of his, how would he respond to the argument that the Torah only prohibits using a kli in the first 24 hours when it's no sein tam l'shvach, when it gives a positive flavor? So how do you know in the first place that no sein tam l'fgam would be prohibited? So the Gemara says, that other opinion says that kedera basyoma nami mifgam pagma. Even within the first 24 hours, the stuff that you cook in it usually is pogame a little bit. A little bit, not as much as later, but it's pogame a little bit. And nonetheless, the Torah prohibited it because no sein tam lufgam is always prohibited. So that's where the Gemara leaves this. We paskin no sein tam lufgam is permitted. We paskin that if you cook in vessels that were used with tray food after 24 hours from the last use, we'll talk a little bit more about this next week, that the food, unless it's sharp food, like onions or radishes or things of that nature, or asafoetida, that brings back memories. The food will be permitted to consume, but you're not allowed to cook in that way. You will still have to actually kosher the vessels. One last thing I'll close with right now. Yeah, Marsh.
Question about this.
On the bottom of the question seems foolish to group all three of them because it's so obvious that tefillah has nothing to do with kashrus and it's a mitzvah asad. Why does the Gemara categorize them as three legitimate questions in one block when that seems like it should be moronic based on what we just finished discussing?
So Tosfos, look at the bottom, Tosfos Ayin Hamed Beis. So he observes that if you hold that it's permissible to use the foodstuffs, the Gemara, the Brisa puts them together because they're all mutter. Right? You're right, they're different conceptually, but the end is correct. But what happens if you believe that no Saint Tom of Kam really is Aser, and if you used it without Hagala, without Libum, it's Aser? So Tosa says, you know, he thinks it's just, he doesn't really spell this out, it's just the language that, you know, it's what we call a Shigra de Lishna. It's like, you know, you keep the language together. You want to keep kind of a balance in, you know, a literary balance in the Brisa. But Tosa, what? So Tosis raises the possibility, maybe, that position believes that the food would be usher after you have tefillah. Right. So we don't paskin that way, for sure. And for us, it's not tied to the Liban Hagal issue. As Tosis is aware, as you're aware, they're two totally unrelated issues. We could have made a similar gzera. Now, maybe you're more likely to make a gzera if you hold no Saint Tom of Gam as usher, since if you ever use it without Hagala, or you ever use it without Libun, it's going to be prohibited. So maybe you should also make it without Tefillah, even though the logic still doesn't really fly. Now, as a Tosis throws out, Gabe, maybe you could say there's a Gzera. We don't really actually assume that way. Again, but maybe for Rabbi Meir, no Saint Tom of Gam is also, maybe he would say that, but it's hard to know because we don't actually paskin that way. All right, so we'll stop here. Next week, there are two bonus issues that relate to this topic before we move on to the Gemara. Number one, what is the different definition of a kli that is not ben yomo? I've been saying repeatedly over and over, it means it hasn't been used in 24 hours, but that's actually a major machlokas harishonim. I'm giving you what we use as the general rule practically, but it's subject to debate. And then the second question would be the following. Supposing you had, let's say, a milchik, you cooked meat in a pot, and then 15 hours later, you boiled water in the pot, and then 15 hours later, you cook milk in the pot. The question is, does that boiling of water in the interim have any impact upon the status of the kli? It's a very famous Sefer HaTruma that Tosfos quotes. It's discussed extensively in Shulchan Aruch as to what the Sefer HaTruma meant, who discusses that issue. So we will, God willing, next week talk about those issues before moving on in the Gemara. Yes?
Just to refresh. So you and your family rent a condo. You arrive.
Right.
The owner confirms to you that no one had it the day before. Mm-hmm. So nothing is a ben yomo. You would take their pots, fill them with hot water, let's say the bigger pots, not the frying pans, we'll leave those aside.
Right. That's a complicated issue.
And just boil them over, let's assume you get a hot rock to get it mm-hmm. or more boiling water. And you would just use them that night for dinner.
Yeah. Why not?
This is crazy.
Why is that crazy? Marshall, you're kashuing the kalim. You're worried about, oh, you don't, has it not been 24 hours? That's what would be, let's say you took it to your house. What, you can't kashu non-kosher kalim by doing a proper hagala? Okay.
Culturally, you're